Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience and today's episode contains language and violence. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 17. Lord Victor Woodburn Makes a Point. Winston stalked the street, rubbing his temples. Every impact of his boots upon the cobbles sent a throb of pain to his skull.
Gods, these Thursday morning headaches are as regular as prunes. I only had 2 glasses of wine. I wonder if the others feel this way.
A wry smile crept across his lip.
Although I know 2 people feeling pretty good this morning.
Coffee and breakfast from a street cart did little to soothe his head. The pounding grew when he sprang a surprised inspection on some journeyman watch officers he caught idling in the yard. Between all 4 of them, they were missing the contents of at least 1 full watch kit. He had them each do 10 push-ups for failing to have a full kit.
And not one of you has the most important thing.
All 4 stood at attention, backs ramrod straight and eyes front, and all stank of nervous sweat.
Soap,
he went on, producing a whitish lump from his pouch and brandishing it between thumb and forefinger.
This is one of the most important things you carry. Not one of you has any.
There it is, hanging in the air. They want to ask, but they're too afraid.
Droplets crept down one boy's cheek. Winston pointed.
You, Langer, go ahead.
Langer gulped.
But, Captain, why? I mean, I got everything else. Whistle, medical supplies, my journal for notes.
Although I wonder about the usefulness of your journal. I've seen how you write, son, and writing and etching are 2 very different things. It's no good keeping a journal if you can see through all the pages.
The big captain conceded the point, nodding.
And all those are vital to your gear, but soap is just as important. You clean wounds with it, you clean your gear with it, and most of all, you clean yourself. If somebody pukes in your face at the beginning of your shift, you might spend the next 10 hours with it in your hair, depending on how your day goes. Blood, vomit, shit, piss, cum, you never know what you'll get on you. Lord Thaxton told me that people at the Academy believe that regular washing can keep diseases from spreading. Now, I doubt that's true, but at the very least, if you get something nasty thrown at you, you'll be glad you had this along.
He stuck it back in his pouch and dismissed them. Sergeant Tomlin had noticed the inspection and wandered over. His red hair flamed in the sun.
Bless you, Tomlin. Most sergeants would have hidden if they saw their charges being dressed down, but you're a natural busybody and you'll make a fine officer some day.
Tomlin saluted. I'll take care to order more soap, sir. I think it's the summertime. It's warm enough to have a wash, so they go crazy.
Aye, see to it.
A small boy in castle livery appeared at his elbow. The boy presented a scroll, saluted, and then ran off, all without speaking a word. Winston noted the seafoam green ribbon on the scroll with a sinking feeling.
Good news? Tomlin asked hopefully.
Winston grunted as he read.
Great news. They've given me almost 20 minutes to be at the castle.
He re-rolled the scroll and tucked it away in his pouch.
No time to run home for anything formal. Well, they'll have to take me as I am. At least it's not a hot day. I wonder where we're meeting at the stables.
Winston found Tomlin's eager face staring up at him.
When Lieutenant Luthers comes on at noon, let him know where I've gone and that he's in charge until I get back, just as if it were a normal Thursday. I'll send him a message if I'll be longer than the evening.
Yes, sir.
The castle stables crawled with activity. Over 12 coaches waited in a line that led through the main archway, including Alistair's midnight blue and gray one. 20 rangers stood by, all on horseback. Captain Micah Tilders, the Rangers' watch captain, was at their head on her great imperial horse. 50 of the palace guard accompanied the column, on foot in splendid scale mail. Grooms and stable boys roamed thither and yon, and Winston had to weave through the mass of bodies as he walked.
It's not a parade, that's for sure. Some of these nobles look dressed for hunting or riding. I don't see Victor anywhere, and I don't think he has a coach. I'll just listen for Alistair and report to him." A little man appeared before him, his hand up. "Victor's clerk, the one who's always with him." The name didn't leap to mind.
"He always has that look on his face like he's constipated. Small wonder, I can't imagine what the poor man's life must be like."
"There you are," the clerk said, as if Winston was a small child who had gone wandering. "Come with me, Captain. I'll show you where to ride." He flapped his hand for Winston to follow. Grudgingly, Winston trailed along behind him.
"Where are we going? I mean, why was everyone summoned?"
"It is a surprise. His lordship, I mean Lord Woodburn, specifically instructed no one be made aware."
"Well, is it safe for his grace?"
The man cast a sharp look over his shoulder.
"I think we can trust the lady's official spy master not to lead us to harm."
They passed Lady Orswell's beautiful dark green coach and team of bay stallions. The clerk led him to a plain pine wood coach pulled by a mix of beasts. A face peered out through the open door. It caught sight of Winston, and the vague distaste there fermented into honest disgust.
"Jelly beef."
Decked out in yellow as usual, Chamberlain Maine Gordon looked as cheerful as a wet cockerel. He reeked of hair oil. Winston kept his face neutral as he nodded in greeting. He climbed inside, making the coach tilt and creak. Gordon made some kind of small, strained greeting, then went back to looking out the window in feigned fascination. The silence stretched on until there was a shout from outside. The coach lurched into action. Creaking and rumbling, the bench wobbled beneath the thin cushion. Gordon resumed his resolute search for anything outside the coach's window more interesting than Winston.
"Perhaps I'm being too hard on him. Maybe this ride will let us get to know each other better, and we'll find out we have something in common. I should wait for him to address me, though, since he sits at the table and is practically a lord."
1 hour of silent contemplation later, the coach rattled to a halt. Bereft of conversation, Winston had been content to watch the countryside creep past from the coach window. The city's enormous walls gave way to rolling hills, mostly gray and brown now since the harvest had come and gone. Farms and houses fell behind, and knots of people stood near the roads, waving at the procession. A few large, grand houses were visible, and he soothed his vague envy by reminding himself of the enormous cost to keep up such places. Now Winston opened the door and stepped out. Like several dozen other people, he stretched and flexed his legs after sitting in the bouncing coach for so long. The sun was high, but noon was still more than an hour away.
"We left through the Sea God Gate, so we're north of the city, which means that this is..."
A fortress crouched on the hill above. Dark gray stone rose in towers, turrets, and rough, frowning walls. The structure backed on the sea cliffs. Now he was free of the lemony fog surrounding Chamberlain Gordon, he smelled brine. Carts clustered around the open gates, loaded with pallets of wood and stone. A distinct air of urgent busyness permeated the air around the construction, and crashing waves underlay all.
"Where are we?" Gordon asked.
He'd worn thin, soft leather palace slippers and glanced with equal disdain at the muddy ground and Winston's proffered hand. After a long second, he took the hand and stepped down.
"Edgewater."
"And what, pray tell, is Edgewater?" Winston stepped back and took in the structure.
"An old imperial fortress. After the Empire fell, it was abandoned. There are 6 others up and down the coast of northern Vitral. We use them for watchtowers, not much more."
He left Gordon to his own devices and went down the line, looking for anyone he knew. All told, there were about 30 nobles and public servants, and 5 captains of the city, and several scribes in the party.
"Oh, there he is. Alistair, Plowright, Galbraith, the whole table. And Bedloe."
Winston took up a place behind them and tried to look inconspicuous as he eavesdropped. Lady Renee Orswell appeared out of nowhere.
"Ah, Captain, so good to see you."
She wore trousers, leather riding boots, a short cloak, and gloves. Her hair was bound into braids that streamed down her back.
She'd ridden in her coach, but at least she looked prepared to ride on horseback if needed.
"Good afternoon, my lady."
"This is all rather secretive, isn't it?" she said, taking his arm.
"Yes, my lady."
The rest of the group turned to take him in. All of them, including Alistair, wore leathers and trousers of some kind.
"Well done, lad!"
Alistair boomed, patting Winston on the back and moving on. The rest of the group moved away as well.
"Do you enjoy secrets, Captain?"
"Why did I think of her when I met Adelaide? They look nothing alike, even from this angle."
A lifetime of being the tallest person in the room had taught him to keep his eyes on women's faces, no matter how they leaned or moved.
"I couldn't say, my lady. I don't know any secrets."
"Indeed."
A sly smile spread across her lips, and she winked.
"If you would excuse me."
She released him and moved on to speak to Lord Galbraith.
"What the hell was that about?"
Someone else appeared at his elbow. "And you believe they invited me?" Esteban said, grinning up at him. "Perhaps they've come to their senses and are naming me Lord Commander at last." Winston chuckled.
"Gods help us, you'd sell us to the pirates and our Armisans for a keg of cheap ale."
"Certainly to the pirates, but to those dogs the Armisans, 2 kegs, I have some rational pride." The clerk reappeared and called them to attention.
"Your Grace, lords and ladies, we will now proceed into the fortress. Please excuse the mess, it is currently being renovated. I would also point out that it is terribly important you stay with the group, as several sections of the fortress are no longer safe. Accidents could happen. If you would follow me, please."
20 minutes of shuffling and herding later, the group stood on a wide gallery overlooking an expansive sand-floored courtyard at the fortress's center.
"Please take a moment to find a place at the edge. We want everyone to be able to see."
The gallery wasn't long enough for everyone to stand at the balustrade, so the taller people took places at the back. Winston found himself standing behind Esteban.
"Everyone can see the center of the courtyard?"
There was more resettling, a cleared throat, murmurs of assent, and then silence. The clerk nodded and pulled a whistle from his pocket. He unleashed a single short blast. Down below, 2 figures emerged from a doorway.
Albemarle.
Even from afar, the cold, handsome face was unmistakable. Months had not dulled Winston's memory of the blonde bully.
"Shaved his head, too, and with him. The other one looks familiar."
The second man was older, in his 40s, and tall. Both men were stripped to the waist, shoeless, and wore thin breeches. Both were lean and raw-edged as they strode to the center of the courtyard.
"Albemarle's nearly swaggering, but the other one is all business."
Esteban swore under his breath. Each man carried 2 naked cutlasses. Winston thought he saw Plowright looking in his direction. When he turned his head, the master of plow was watching the demonstration. The audience became restive, glancing at each other. Shoes scraped on stone as people jostled to see. Curious mutters arose. The men reached the center of the sand-floored courtyard and took up positions, their backs straight and shoulders taut. A 3rd figure emerged from the doorway. Dressed in his usual shabby blacks, Lord Victor Woodborne strode toward the pair, but stopped about 20 feet away. Once in place, the huntsman spoke a single word the audience was too far away to hear. 4 blades crossed over the men's heads in salute. Sunlight turned them into white X's. Esteban glanced up at Winston, his face dark.
"What is this?" someone asked.
"My lord will explain everything after the demonstration," the clerk responded.
The pair in the courtyard lowered their swords, turned to each other, and bowed. Then they raised their blades to a ready position, each taking a step back.
"Spatter's first position," Esteban remarked in a low voice. "Used for close quarters when the feet must stay still. Pirates use it for fighting below decks."
Victor spoke another word. Albemarle thrust his right arm toward the other's torso. The man brought his opposite arm around and knocked the blade aside, then made to punch the boy with the knuckle guard of his other sword.
Albemarle dodged the blow by dropping to one knee, but the man reversed his swing, elbowing the boy in the face. Winston chewed his lip. Albemarle's movements were all youthful speed and bravado. The other man, who Winston realized now was probably a swordmaster and teacher, made no purposeless movements. He waited, he blocked, he struck, and he waited again. Victor issued another command. The two began circling. Spatter second. Esteban crossed his arms. The feet move a little more, but not much. It's for slippery decks, thick sand on beaches. Albemarle spat a pink gobbet onto the sand. Then he darted forward. The master stepped and turned. Albemarle's blade slit air. The master lifted his inside leg, planted his foot behind Albemarle's ankle, and flung the boy to the ground. Albemarle made to roll away, but the other's sword point was at his neck. He lay back down.
Albemarle's fast, I'll give him that, but that other one? Not a single wasted movement there, no flailing or staggering. He knows every angle, and he's just watching to see how best to move.
Victor spoke again, and the master helped Albemarle up.
This is all well and good if you're facing a foe who's been trained in sword work on the battlefield, but most of the time we're wrestling drunks in dark alleys trying not to kill someone. We're not fighting pirates and soldiers, we're subduing citizens.
At another command from Lord Woodburn, the combatants flung their swords away and faced each other. Then they rushed.
This looks more familiar.
They grappled for a moment, then broke. Albemarle sidestepped, lashing out with a foot. It landed in the other side with a smack like an open hand on a side of beef. The other staggered, and Albemarle swung for his face. The other caught the boy's wrist, took a step to the side, then twisted and brought his attacker to his knees. Albemarle tried to strike his opponent's knee, but the master kept just beyond reach. At another word from Victor, the master broke the hold and Albemarle rose. They faced each other again and closed. The master caught a punch aimed at his jaw, but he inclined his head and the blow glanced off his cheekbone. He stepped forward, wrapping his arms around the boy's torso, again planted his foot inside Albemarle's and twisted. The boy went down again, knocking up a spray of sand. Victor gave another command. The master helped Albemarle to his feet, giving him a companionable pat on the shoulder. They bowed to each other, then returned to their original positions and bowed to the assembly. Red marks spotted their skin, and red trickled from the corner of Albemarle's mouth. The clerk began clapping. Alistair followed. The rest of the group were soon applauding. The clerk ceased and cleared his throat.
"Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention and patience. If you would please join us down in the courtyard, my lord would explain today's demonstration and answer any questions you may have. Please follow me down to the courtyard, where you will find refreshments."
The reception hall was missing its roof, but in all other ways was accommodating. There was wine and a table laden with food. Winston helped himself to shrimp, roasted apples, and cheese. He spent some time catching up with the other watch captains. Bedloe was nowhere to be seen, before he wandered away. Esteban stood in the corner. The old swordmaster clutched a forgotten cup in his hand, his eyes lost in thought. Winston nudged him.
"You all right? Eh?"
The brown eyes raised up, then back down.
"Ah, yes, yes. Very interesting."
"What did you think?"
Esteban nodded and remembered his wine. He downed it in a single gulp.
"A lot of things."
He glanced at Winston.
"But nothing anyone wants to hear."
When he finally appeared, Lord Victor Woodburn wasted little time with niceties. He strode to the center of the room, waited until they encircled him, and then began speaking.
"Lords, ladies, captains, quite simply the old ways no longer work. There is a new kind of threat on the street, and we must rise to meet it with new methods, new thinking. Jalen Etrigar, formerly of His Majesty King Thoraya's Palace Guard, is leading this effort. He has been assisting Captain Jefferson Bedloe in Dockside and will soon be taking over as captain of the Summer Palace. He will be my second in command. He will begin training the whole watch in these new fighting techniques within a fortnight. Additionally, we will create an elite force within the watch to be called out in special circumstances. Are there any questions?"
Polite silence hung in the air as people tried to wrap their minds around so much information. Jehan Plowright raised a hand.
"My lord, I'm sure you've already thought of this, but what uniforms will they wear? What makes them different from our current forces? Who will pay them? Who do they answer to?"
A muscle tensed at Victor's jaw.
"They will wear no uniforms. They will not patrol down the street ringing bells and crying out that all is well. They will dress and act as normal everyday citizens and incorporate themselves seamlessly into the population."
The gray eye regarded Plowright for a moment.
"As to who they answer to, they answer to me."
Plowright nodded but looked far from content.
"This new force will undergo rigorous physical training. They will not lie around drunk on their days off. They will be required to perform physically and prove themselves in combat, unarmed and armed. Etrigar has created training that includes different fighting styles from around the Sandoval Sea and beyond." "If you will excuse me."
Without another word, he turned and walked off. It was difficult to say what had shocked the group more. The demonstration, the announcement of completely changing the watch's workings, or Victor's uncouthness. His clerk materialized and thanked everyone for coming, informing them that any further questions could be addressed to the Lord Commander in the form of a letter. Winston turned to head back to the coaches, and nearly jumped out of his skin when a hand landed on his shoulder. He turned and found the broad, handsome face of the Master of Plow.
"Good afternoon, Captain. I was hoping to speak with you about manpower for the Duchess's parade. My coach is just this way."
"Of course, your lordship."
He followed Plowright to the coach.
"I'd ask you to join me for the ride back, but we wouldn't be alone. It'll be a little while until we're moving, so we should have a good 20 minutes.
The coach's interior smelled of leather and pipe smoke. It was modest by some standards, but still worlds away from the box Winston and Gordon had arrived in. Winston settled himself on the seat. The leather creaked and squealed. Plowright gave him an appraising look, then leaned on the armrest, folding his arms.
"So, what did you think of that little show?"
"My lord?"
"Do you feel safer already?"
Winston licked his lips.
"It was a most impressive demonstration, my lord."
Plowright blinked at this noncommittal answer.
"You keep things close. I respect that."
He crossed his legs.
"Are you a student of history, Captain Imborn?"
"Somewhat. I suppose if you count all the history Gerald and I took pains to burn, then yes. Gods, that feels like it happened 100 years ago. I didn't see Plowright's name in any of that, but that doesn't mean much."
"Well, I am a student of history, Captain. I learned to read at 17, took advantage of the free lessons at the academy while I was selling my father's crops at the market. Now I read as much as I can get my hands on. I even pay a young man to read books at me while I work. A ridiculous luxury for some, I know, but worth it. Not to mention the gallons of hot lemon tea he goes through to keep from losing his voice. But whether you're interested in the past or not, I'm sure you know what happens when you send armed soldiers to keep the peace in a city."
"I do."
Plowright smiled and leaned against the wall of the coach.
50 years ago, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. The swords were useful in their time. They made peace during the troubled times and kept the streets safe. But they did it with fear and force. Lord Alistair and a few other lords and ladies are old enough to remember the first swords, but they were safe in the castle. They had good thick doors to shut and servants to protect them. My grandfather didn't, and he was cut down because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's why my family moved outside the walls. I saw some of the others' faces while they were watching. They think this is a good idea. I don't. I can't believe things have gotten so bad that we need this. Not the way that Victor is training them. And I like the idea of an invisible force in the city, under his command, even less."
"Since we are being frank, my lord, I don't like it either. But I only know rumors of the swords. Who were they? What did they do?"
Plowright looked out the window, his finger tapping the frame. They were assembled from the best fighters from the Navy, the Watch, and the Palace Guard. They were trained to act as both watchmen and soldiers, which is a difficult line to walk even in the best of times. And in a time when your old neighbor might break into your house in search of food, well, you know how difficult it can be getting to the bottom of a crime. Who's telling the truth? Who's really guilty? Is the criminal the man who stole the bread, or the man who stole the thief's livelihood so he must steal bread to live?
We leave those questions for the magistrates.
Of course, which is supposed to happen. But that happens later, sometimes days or weeks, and meanwhile some poor soul is languishing in the watch cells, awaiting trial, where their crops go unharvested, goods unsold, family unfed. But I digress. The swords didn't leave things to the magistrates or even give the benefit of the doubt. They dragged everyone to the jail. The cells were overflowing, and the orphanages and workhouses as well. It didn't matter who saw what or who did what. It was easier to just round up everyone and dump them in the prisons. Even Castlecliff was packed to the gills with people. Plowright glanced at him. What do you think happens when that happens? When the people can't trust the watch? Winston's finger picked at a brass stud in the seat next to him.
The Middlers choose sides.
They do indeed. Have you ever heard someone on the watch describe people as dogs, sheep, or wolves?
Yes, sheep are the people, and dogs herd them and protect them from the wolves.
Plowright pursed his lips. Have you ever found yourself in agreement with that philosophy?
No, sir.
The tawny eyes fastened on him. Why ever not?
Because people can change. Sometimes a little lamb born to law-abiding sheep grows into a predator, or a sheepdog who's been fighting too long gets to like the taste of blood. People have long lives, and a lot can happen that changes them.
Indeed. A half-smile cocked Plowright's mouth, and he nodded in satisfaction.
I've even heard tales of men making pets of wolves.
Indeed, the Middlers choose sides. Maybe not right away, but nothing happens in a dark room. People see things. They remember things. Things happen to parents, older brothers, sisters, cousins, neighbors, and the ones left behind remember. They remember and learn to distrust the watch, to fear them. Or worse, they learn how to get away with what someone else didn't. If you manage to wipe out one generation of criminals, you create another in the same stroke. I believe in keeping this city safe. Perhaps I'm naive, but I haven't given up on it, and I don't believe that turning its streets into a battleground is the way to serve it. He leaned forward. But I am just one member of the table. I can only do so much. I hope I can count on you if the need arises.
Aye, my lord. I hope so, too.
Plowright knocked on the coach door and a servant opened it.
That depends on what the need is.
This concludes Chapter 17 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 18, in which a pair grows closer, Neville takes a risk on a new venture, and the city takes a break for a parade. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon later this year. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.